readers, welcome to The Book Report. I'm your host, Elaine Charles, and I've got an eye on the calendar. Memorial Day looms large, and with it, my solemn duty to provide you with a spot-on list of books to take on vacation. Summer reading has a different flavor, doesn't it? It's a bit more fun, more escapist, with the accent on adventure and action. I'll give you a suitcase full of options over the next few weeks, but I've decided to kick it off with a rip-roaring literary salute to whodunit. There's a great new crop out there for our consideration. So, quicker than you can say, the butler did it, we'll turn to page one of the book report.
Traditional advertising can be expensive and wasteful. But lately, you've been hearing a lot about social media and viral marketing. But let's be honest, it's confusing. That's why you need Magic Buzz, a new marketing company so unique, we've even coined a special phrase for what we do. Socio-viral. We combine the word-of-mouth friendliness of social media, like Facebook, Twitter, together with the viral reach power of YouTube, to create the socio-viral effect. The Magic Buzz team makes sure our clients are well represented online. We recently took word-of-mouth advertising to the number one position as most productive medium for a major cell phone company. That's right. Magic Buzz produced more sales than an expensive TV campaign at a fraction of the cost. Put the power of socio-viral marketing to work for you. Visit us at magicbuzz.com. MAGICBUZ.com. If you have any questions, please feel free to email us at info@magicbuzz.com. Magic Buzz, we're there when you can't be.
The year is 1940. Winston Churchill has just been sworn in. War rages across the Channel, and the threat of a blitz in London looms larger by the day. But none of this deters Maggie Hope. She's graduated at the top of her class and possesses the skills of the finest minds in British intelligence. Sadly, her gender qualifies her only to be the newest typist at number 10 Downing Street. But with a remarkable gift for code breaking, Maggie finds that working for the Prime Minister affords her a level of clearance she could never have imagined, and opportunities she will not let pass. In Mr. Churchill's Secretary, by Susan Elia McNeil, Maggie becomes ensnared in a web of spies, murder, and intrigue. She must work quickly to balance her duty to king and country with her own chances of survival. And when she unravels a mystery that points toward her own family's hidden secrets, she'll discover her quick wits are all that stand between an assassin's plan and her beloved Mr. Churchill. Wanda McCadden narrates.
I would say to the House, as I've said to those who have joined this government, I have nothing to offer but blood, toil, tears, and sweat. We have before us an ordeal of the most grievous kind. We have before us many, many long months of struggle and suffering, intoned Winston Leonard Spencer Churchill to the House of Commons and the British nation in his first speech as the new Prime Minister. There must have been complete silence in the House, although there was a burst of static over the airwaves as Maggie leaned forward to listen to the BBC on the wireless. She and Paige sat at the kitchen table and clasped hands, listening to the address. Charlotte, better known as Chuck, entered the kitchen quietly and leaned against the doorframe.
You ask, what is our policy? I can say, it is to wage war by sea, land and air with all our might and with all the strength that God can give us. To wage war against a monstrous tyranny, never surpassed in the dark, lamentable catalogue of human crime. That is our policy. You ask, what is our aim? I can answer in one word. It is victory. Victory at all costs. Victory in spite of all terror. Victory, however long and hard the road may be. For without victory, there is no survival. Let that be realised. No survival for the British Empire. No survival for all that the British Empire has stood for. No survival for the urge and impulse of the ages, that mankind will move forward towards its goal.
Chuck nodded her acknowledgement of both girls. Together they all listened to the speech's conclusion in tense silence.
But I take up my task with buoyancy and hope. I feel sure that our cause will not be suffered to fail among men. At this time I feel entitled to claim the aid of all, and I say, come then, let us go forward together with our united strength.
The three girls were perfectly still and silent for a moment as the word gravity washed over them.
Well, at least it's the truth, Maggie said, pushing back a stray lock of red hair. He didn't try to pretend everything's all right and fob us off with easy comfort and lies.
I just don't know, Chuck said to both girls as a tinny version of God Save the King played and she walked over to click off the wireless.
Look what happened in Poland. Look what's happening in Belgium and Holland and France, Paige said. Maybe Ambassador Kennedy was right. He said Hitler doesn't want England. And if we just...
Chuck gave a snort.
All right, and then they'll stop. You really believe that? This is a different kind of war, Maggie said, a people's war. It's not just soldiers on the front line, it's civilians. We are the new front line.
As she said the words, her chest constricted a bit. It was true, England might still be in the Boer, B-O-R-E, war, where nothing dangerous was really happening, but things were about to change. Nazis had invaded most of Europe and were undoubtedly moving toward England. Would troops try to invade by sea or parachute down from the sky? Either way, the scenario was grim.
Yeah, said Chuck. We're as likely to be bombed here in our own home as the soldiers over in France.
Stop it, Paige said, covering her ears. Just stop. Chuck frowned and pulled her bottle-green cardigan sweater around her, rather like a general settling his uniform before going once more onto the breach.
Tea,
she stated in her deep, booming voice, deliberately changing the subject.
We all need tea. There'll be no blood, toil, tears or sweat until I have some tea.
That was Chuck, practical and pragmatic. More handsome than beautiful, with rich chestnut-brown hair, strong features and thick black eyelashes, Chuck McCaffrey had worked for the U.S. Ambassador Joseph Kennedy, along with Paige Kelly, before the war had started. Maggie Hope had come to London for another reason altogether, to sell her late grandmother's great leaking, creaking pile of a Victorian house. But when Britain declared war and Joseph Kennedy began being quoted in the papers spouting pro-Nazi sentiments, Paige and Chuck both quit their jobs with the ambassador and lost their embassy housing.
We've just heard Mr. Churchill's Secretary by Susan Elia McNeil. Thomas Pitt, once a lowly policeman, is now the powerful head of Britain's special branch. He and his beloved Charlotte are also the heroes of 26 popular tales by Anne Perry. Now, in number 27, Dorchester Terrace, some people fear that Thomas may have been promoted beyond his abilities. He, too, feels painful moments of self-doubt, especially as rumors reach him of a plot to blow up a part of the Dover-London rail line, on which an Austrian duke is soon to travel. Why would anyone destroy an entire train to kill one obscure Austrian royal? Or are the rumors designed to distract Pitt from an even more devastating plot? He must resolve this riddle at once before the damage is done. Michael Page narrates.
Narraway had not added, God help you, though he might as well have. Then a dry humour had softened his eyes for a moment. Pitt had seen a flicker of compassion there for the burden that lay ahead, and also a hint of envy, regret for the excitement lost, the pounding of the blood and the fire of the mind that Narraway was being forced to give up. Of course Pitt had seen him since then, but only briefly. There had been social events here and there, conversations that were polite but devoid of meaning beyond the courtesies. The questions as to how each of them was learning to bend, to adapt and alter his stride to a new role, remained unspoken. Pitt sat down again at his desk and turned his attention to the papers in front of him. There was a brief knock on the door. "Come in," he said. The door opened at once and Stoker entered. Thanks to the events in Ireland, he was the one man in the branch that Pitt knew for certain he could trust. "Yes," he said as Stoker came to stand in front of Pitt's desk. He looked worried and uncomfortable, his lean face more expressive than usual. "Got a report in from Hutchins in Dover, sir. Seen one or two unusual people coming over on the ferry. Troublemakers. Not the usual sort of political talkers, more like the ones who really do things. He's pretty sure at least one of them was involved in the murder of the French Prime Minister the year before last." Pitt felt a knot tighten in his stomach. No wonder Stoker looked so worried. "Tell him to do all he can to be absolutely sure of their identities," he replied. "Send Barker down as well. Watch the trains. We need to know if any of them come up to London, and who they contact if they do." "It may be nothing," Stoker said without conviction. "Hutchins is a bit jumpy." Pitt drew in his breath to say that it was Hutchins's job to be overcautious, then changed his mind. Stoker knew that as well as he did. "Still, we should keep our eyes open. We've enough men in Dover to do that with Barker." "Yes, sir. Thank you." Stoker turned and left. Pitt sat without moving for a moment or two. If it really was one of the French Prime Minister's assassins, would the French police or Secret Service get in touch with him? Would they want his help or prefer to deal with the man themselves? They might hope to get information about other anarchists from him. Or, on the other hand, they might simply contrive for him to meet with an accident, so the whole matter would never reach the public eye. If the latter were the case, it would be better if the British Special Branch pretended not to be aware of the situation. Pitt would have to make the decision about whether to involve the Special Branch, and to what extent, later, when he had more information. It was the type of decision Narraway had referred to, a grey area, fraught with moral difficulties. Pitt bent back to the papers he had been reading. There was a reception that evening. 100 or so people of social and political importance would be gathered, ostensibly to hear the latest violin prodigy playing a selection of chamber pieces. In truth, it would be a room full of people attempting to observe and manipulate any shifts in political power, and to subtly exchange information that could not be passed in the more rigid settings of an office. Pitt walked through the front door of his house in Keppel Street just after 7 o'clock, with plenty of time to get ready for the reception. He found himself smiling at the immediate warmth, a relief after the bitter wind outside. The familiar smells of baked bread and clean cotton drifted from the kitchen at the far end of the passage. Charlotte would be upstairs dressing. She was not yet used to being back in the glamour and rivalry of the high society into which she had been born. She had found it shallow when she was younger, and then, after marrying Pitt, it had been out of her reach. Now he knew, although she had never once said so, that at times she had missed the colour and wit of it all, however superficial it was. Minnie Maud was in the kitchen preparing Welsh rabbit for him, in case the refreshments at the event were meagre. Her hair was flying out of its pins, as usual, her face flushed with exertion, and perhaps a certain excitement. She swung around from the big stove as soon as she heard his footsteps.
That was Dorchester Terrace by Anne Perry. Stockholm author Jens Lapidus is a criminal defense lawyer who's represented some of Sweden's most notorious underworld criminals. Many compare his writing to Stieg Larsson. Easy Money, the first book in his Stockholm noir trilogy, has been called a searing debut. Publishers Weekly wrote, quote, "This sprawling novel exposes moral degradation of every stripe while relentlessly depicting Sweden's underworld and the reasons it exists and grows." Welcome, Jens. Thanks so much for stopping by the Book Report.
Thank you.
I wanted to ask you, what inspired you to write Easy Money?
Well, a lot of the inspiration question comes from my job as a criminal defense lawyer, public criminal defense lawyer. And actually, there was a very specific instance. We were having a trial. Three young men were being prosecuted for assaulting and robbery in an apartment in Stockholm. And at the end of the trial, the judge, she turned to them and she asked, where are you in 5 years? Who are you in 5 years? She wasn't really expecting them to, I think, say that they wanted to change their life and getting jobs and education, but instead they got very upset with her and they started basically shouting in the courtroom. And they went, you don't understand anything, you don't understand where we come from, you don't understand the life we live, you don't understand what we do is normal to us. So I remember clearly coming home that night, I switched on the computer and I wrote my first fictional piece ever, and this was about an assault and robbery in an apartment, but I did write it from the perspective of the criminals themselves. So that was the first thing I ever wrote, because I figured if in Sweden there are people for whom committing crime is normal, then it's also must be fascinating to go into the heads of these people.
Well, Easy Money is book one of your Stockholm Noir trilogy. Did you know when you started writing it that it was going to be a trilogy?
No, I didn't really. I knew that I wanted to depict a piece of Sweden that normally or have never before been really depicted in literature. I did not know whether I wanted to write 1, 2, 3, 5, 10 books on the subject. I guess my publishing house thought that trilogy sounded well, and I wonder why. But it really, that's how it came out at the end.
So how long did it take you to write book one versus book two versus book three?
Well, it's taking me longer and longer. All in all, these three books took me 7 years to write. I think the first book took around 2 years, and then longer and longer for the rest of the books. When I wrote my first book, I didn't have children, so I could use a lot of night time and evenings writing it. Now I have two kids, so everything, I'm tired at night. I need to sleep.
So do book two and book three actually still involve the three main characters from book one, or how do they weave the story along?
Yeah, well, I see all of my three books as basically one tale describing a universe, Stockholm as not seen before, the underworld, the gutter, the streets. Some of the characters are in all my three books, some just appear in one, some come back in the third book, but they're all there to some extent, unless they die.
All right, so you're a criminal defense attorney. Do some of your current clients actually see themselves in your book, and is that a little dangerous for you?
That is a dilemma for me. It's a holy principle, the client-attorney privilege, and I don't think I would last long as a lawyer if my clients knew that if they talk to me 1 year later, they will appear in my books. So I keep a very close eye on that, and I really get a lot of help from my colleagues. They read my manuscripts and so forth. In order not to disclose in an open way any of my clients. So I always have to twist the story or the details so that they're not recognizable.
All right. In Easy Money, there are actually three main characters. Was one of them easier for you to write than the others?
Well, maybe at the start, but spending a lot of time in my head with these characters, after like 1 year, they become like close friends of mine. At the early stages of writing the book, I really had to think, now, how is he going to react to this? How is she going to react to this? After a year, I know these people. It's like old friends. You know they're going to laugh at a joke, or you know they're not going to like your joke. You know it before you tell the joke. And it's the same with these characters. So I would say at the early stages, yes, but then they just came to me, sort of.
One of your characters, Murado, is a hitman, yet he has a 7-year-old daughter. How is he able to compartmentalize his life?
See, that is one of the big questions that he asks himself in the book, really. And I wanted to depict the character that you normally, when you read about him, a hitman, someone that hurt other people, you despise such a man. But when you read about him, I wanted to make the picture a little bit deeper and sort of confusing the reader and getting the reader into his head and getting the reader to see that he really cares about his daughter. So So he is actually a human being too, and that might sort of move you into his head, and maybe at least for a few seconds when you read about him, you might start to see the world via his eyes. Mm. So yeah, that is sort of a balance, and that there is a tension there. All my characters are criminals. They commit really bad acts. At the same time, they're human beings.
How was it to have your book turned into a film, and how were you involved?
That was very scary. I was very nervous. My little baby, turn my little baby over to someone else. Fortunately, I'm a lawyer, you know, so I had it in the contract that if they would not take my advice, they were not allowed to use the name and my name and the characters and so forth. So I had a pretty strong veto right. Even though I had that, I didn't really get involved in the writing of the screenplay and so forth. I sort of supervised the process, but it wasn't my process because I didn't have the time and the knowledge, really. So at the end, I wasn't so involved in it. It came out really well, I think. The Swedish movie is out in the U.S. in July. And it really, they managed to keep this feeling of the real, the authentic feeling. And it was a great success in Sweden, this movie. I remember when it came out, it was the same time as Avatar all over the world. Mm. So you had on all the billboards, you had Avatar number one spot, and then suddenly came Sweden and you had Easy Money on the number one spot. So the phone really started ringing with the director, and he was later going over to Hollywood, and he directed a movie that I think is called Safe House that came out with Denzel Washington a couple of months ago here in the U.S.
Is Book 2 going to be a film as well?
Yes, that movie is coming out in Scandinavian countries by the summer.
Ah, all right. Yeah. So let me ask you, do you think American readers are different from your Swedish audience? I know you're on book tour in the U.S., so how are you finding the different audiences?
Well, I think a lot of Americans and also people from Europe, they have a very romanticized picture of Sweden, which to a certain extent is true, but to a certain extent it's really not true. Sweden and Stockholm is like most major European cities with a lot of problems, drug problems, prostitution, domestic violence, extortion and gangs. So a lot of the audience I meet, they believe Sweden is some kind of paradise. And I think from that perspective, it might be really interesting also to read my books or other Scandinavian crime fiction coming out right now, because you really get a different view of Sweden, and that might sort of balance up this very sort of a shiny picture of Sweden.
Hmm. So what's your next project?
Well, I just finished my three books. I recently published my last book in Sweden. Now I'm in the process of writing a lot of short stories, and also I started a new series of books, which will also deal with Stockholm, but coming from a bit of a different angle.
So where can American readers find out more about your books? Tell us what your website is.
Yeah, well, the easiest way is probably to look up my name on Facebook. So that is JENSLAPIDUS, and there is a Facebook page.
Okay. All right. Well, thanks so much for stopping by the Book Report. Your book was a very gripping read. I enjoyed it, and I'm waiting to read book two. Thank you.
Thank you very much for having me.
All righty. Bye.
Barber has been a Massachusetts assistant district attorney for more than 20 years. He's respected in the community, tenacious in the courtroom, and happy at home with his wife Lori and his son Jacob. But then, a shocking crime shatters their New England town, and Andy is blindsided by what happens next. His 14-year-old son is charged with murder of a fellow student. In Defending Jacob by William Landay, Andy rallies to protect his boy. Jacob insists he is innocent, and Andy believes him. But as damning facts and shocking revelations surface, his marriage threatens to crumble. When the trial intensifies, the crisis reveals how little a father knows about his son. Andy faces a trial of his own between loyalty and justice, truth and allegation, between a past he's tried to bury and a future he cannot conceive. Grover Gardner narrates this gripping novel of an embattled family in crisis, a suspenseful, character-driven mystery that is a tale of guilt, betrayal, and the terrifying speed at which our lives can spin out of control.
He was obviously a working-class kid determined to get for himself what so many others had simply been handed. In that way, and only in that way, I suppose, he was just like me. Now, a dozen years after he arrived in the office, despite all his quirks, he had made it, or nearly made it. Neil LaJudas was first assistant, the number two man in the Middlesex District Attorney's Office, the DA's right hand and chief trial attorney. He took over the job from me, this kid who once said to me, "Andy, you're exactly what I want to be someday." I should have seen it coming. In the grand jury room that morning, the jurors were in a sullen, defeated mood. They sat, 30-odd men and women who had not been clever enough to find a way out of serving, all crammed into those school chairs with teardrop-shaped desks for chair arms. They understood their jobs well enough by now. Grand juries serve for months, and they figure out pretty quickly what the gig is all about. Accuse, point your finger, name the wicked one. A grand jury proceeding is not a trial. There is no judge in the room and no defense lawyer. The prosecutor runs the show. It is an investigation, and in theory a check on the prosecutor's power, since the grand jury decides whether the prosecutor has enough evidence to haul a suspect into court for trial. If there is enough evidence, the grand jury grants the prosecutor an indictment, his ticket to superior court. If not, they return a no bill, and the case is over before it begins. In practice, no bills are rare. Most grand juries indict. Why not? They only see one side of the case. But in this case, I suspect the jurors knew LaJudas did not have a case. Not today. The truth was not going to be found, not with evidence this stale and tainted, not after everything that had happened. It had been over a year already, over 12 months since the body of a 14-year-old boy was found in the woods with 3 stab wounds arranged in a line across the chest as if he'd been forked with a trident. But it was not the time so much. It was everything else. Too late, and the grand jury knew it. I knew it, too. Only LaJudas was undeterred. He pursed his lips in that odd way of his. He reviewed his notes on a yellow legal pad, considered his next question. He was doing just what I'd taught him. The voice in his head was mine. Never mind how weak your case is. Stick to the system. Play the game the same way it's been played the last 500-odd years. Use the same gutter tactic that has always governed cross-examination. Lure, trap. He said, "Do you recall when you first heard about the Rifkin boys' murder?" "Yes." "Describe it." "I got a call, I think first from CPAC, that's the state police. Then 2 more came in right away, one from the Newton police, one from the duty DA. I may have the order wrong, but basically the phone started ringing off the hook." "When was this?" "Thursday, April 12th, 2007, around 9 a.m., right after the body was discovered." "Why were you called?" "I was the first assistant. I was notified of every murder in the county. It was standard procedure." "But you did not keep every case, did you? You did not personally investigate and try every homicide that came in?" "No, of course not. I didn't have that kind of time. I kept very few homicides. Most I assigned to other ADAs." "But this one you kept?" "Yes." "Did you decide immediately that you were going to keep it for yourself, or did you only decide that later?" "I decided almost immediately." "Why? Why did you want this case in particular?" "I had an understanding with the district attorney, Lynn Canavan. Certain cases I would try personally." "What sort of cases?" "High-priority cases." "Why you?" "I was the senior trial lawyer in the office. She wanted to be sure that important cases were handled properly." "Who decided if a case was high-priority?" "Me, in the first instance. In consultation with the district attorney, of course, but things tend to move pretty fast at the beginning. There isn't usually time for a meeting." "So you decided the Rifkin murder was a high-priority case?" "Of course." "Why?" "Because it involved the murder of a child. I think we also had an idea it might blow up, catch the media's attention. It was that kind of case.
That was Defending Jacob by William Lande. In July 1890, Vincent van Gogh went into a cornfield and shot himself. Or did he? Why would an artist at the height of his creative powers attempt to take his life and then walk a mile to a doctor's house for help? Who was the crooked little color man Vincent had claimed was stalking him across France? And why had the painter recently become deathly afraid of a certain shade of blue? These are just a few questions at the core of Sacre Bleu by Christopher Moore. Vincent's friends, baker-turned-painter Lucien Lessard and bon vivant Henri Toulouse-Lautrec, vow to discover the truth of Van Gogh's untimely death. Their quest will lead them on a surreal odyssey and a brothel crawl deep into the art world of the late 19th century Paris. This delectable confection of intrigue, passion, and art history is narrated by Ewan Morton.
There's no sun, Dutchman. It's going to rain. Well, it will keep the rain out of my eyes just as well. Vincent studied the gypsy's scarf, yellow with a border of green vines embroidered upon it. Her shawl and skirts, each a different colour, spilled in a tattered rainbow to be muted under a layer of dust at her feet. He should paint her, perhaps, like Millet's peasants, but with a brighter palette. Have the figure stand out against the field. Monsieur Vincent, a young girl's voice. You should get your painting before the storm comes. Adeline Raveau, the innkeeper's daughter, stood in the doorway of the inn, holding a broom poised not for sweeping but for shooing troublesome gypsies. She was 13, blonde, and though she would be a beauty one day, now she was gloriously, heartbreakingly plain. Vincent had painted her portrait 3 times since he'd arrived in May, and the whole time she had flirted with him in the clumsy, awkward manner of a kitten batting at yarn before learning that its claws may actually draw blood. Just practicing, unless poor, tormented painters with one earlobe were suddenly becoming the rage among young girls. Vincent smiled, nodded to Adeline, picked up his easel and canvas, and walked around the corner away from the river. The gypsy fell in beside him as he trudged up the hill past the walled gardens, toward the forest and fields above the village. "I'm sorry, old mother, but I've not a sou to spare," he said to the gypsy. "I'll take the hat," said the gypsy, "and you can go back to your room, out of the storm, and make a picture of a vase of flowers. And what will I get for my hat? Will you tell my future?" "I'm not that kind of gypsy," said the gypsy. "Will you pose for a picture if I give you my hat?" "I'm not that kind of gypsy either." Vincent paused at the base of the steps that had been built into the hillside. "What kind of gypsy are you then?" he asked. "The kind that needs a big yellow hat," said the gypsy. She cackled, flashing her 3 teeth. Vincent smiled at the notion of anyone wanting anything that he had. He took off his hat and handed it to the old woman. He would buy another at market tomorrow. Theo had enclosed a 50-franc note in his last letter, and there was some left. He wanted, no, needed, to paint these storm clouds before they dropped their burden. The gypsy examined the hat, plucked a strand of Vincent's red hair from the straw, and tucked it away into her skirts. She pulled the hat on right over her scarf and struck a pose, her hunchback suddenly straightening. "Beautiful, no?" she said. "Perhaps some flowers in the band," said Vincent, thinking only of colour. "Or a blue ribbon." The gypsy grinned. No, there was a 4th tooth there that he'd missed before. "Au revoir, madame." He picked up his canvas and started up the stairs. "I must paint while I can. It is all I have." "I'm not giving your hat back." "Go with God, old mother." "What happened to your ear, Dutchman? A woman bite it off?" "Something like that," said Vincent. He was halfway up the first of 3 flights of steps. "An ear won't be enough for her. Go back to your room and paint a vase of flowers today. I thought you didn't tell futures. I didn't say I don't see futures, said the gypsy. I just don't tell them.
We've just heard Sacrebleu by Christopher Moore. The Lost Years is this summer's thriller from the legendary Mary Higgins Clark. Dr. Richard Callahan, a world-respected biblical scholar, is astonished when Mariah Lyons shows him a letter left to her by her late father, a distinguished professor of ancient history. The letter, which contains a translation from a 2,000-year-old papyrus scroll, is accompanied by a dusty clay jar and a fragile fragment of papyrus torn from a scroll. If accurate, the translation made by Mariah's father shows that the scroll contains a letter in Christ's own handwriting, and more than that, concerns a pivotal moment in his life. But the rest of the scroll has vanished, and Mariah is aware that someone else wants it and would kill to possess it. Jan Maxwell narrates.
When she was 16, she had been allowed to redecorate it as a birthday present and had chosen to have the walls painted red. For the coverlet and pillows and valances, she had decided on a cheery red and white flowered pattern. The big, comfortable chair in the corner was where she always did her homework, instead of at the desk. Her eyes fell upon the shelf that her father had built over the dresser to hold her trophies from her high school soccer and basketball championship teams. "He was so proud of me," she thought sadly. "He wanted to redecorate again when I finished college, but I never wanted it changed. I don't care if it still has the look of a teenager's room." She tried to remind herself that until now, she had been one of those fortunate people whose only experience with death in the family had been when she was 15 and her 86-year-old grandmother had passed away in her sleep. "I really loved Gran, but I was so grateful that she had been spared a lot of indignity," she thought. "Her strength was failing, and she hated to be dependent on anyone." Mariah stood up, reached for the robe at the foot of the bed, and slipped into it, tying the sash around her slender waist. "But this is different," she thought. "My father did not die a natural death. He was shot while he was reading at his desk in his study downstairs." Her mouth went dry as she asked herself again the same questions she had been asking over and over. Was Mom in the room when it happened? Or did she come in after she heard the sound of the shot? And is there any chance that Mom was the one who did it? Please, God, don't let it turn out to be that way. She walked over to the vanity and looked into the mirror. "I look so pale," she thought as she brushed back her shoulder-length black hair. Her eyes were swollen from all the tears of the last few days. An incongruous thought went through her mind. "I'm glad I have Daddy's dark blue eyes. I'm glad I'm tall like him. It sure helped when I was playing basketball." "I can't believe he is gone," she whispered, recalling his 70th birthday party only 3 weeks earlier. The events of the past 4 days replayed in her mind. On Monday evening, she had stayed at her office to work out an investment plan for a new client. When she got home to her Greenwich Village apartment at 8 o'clock, she had made her usual evening call to her father. "Daddy sounded very down," she remembered. "He told me that Mom had had a terrible day, that it was clear the Alzheimer's was getting worse. Something made me phone back at 10:30. I was worried about both of them. When Daddy didn't answer, I knew that something was wrong." Mariah thought back to that seemingly endless drive from Greenwich Village as she had rushed to New Jersey that night. "I called them again and again on the way over," she thought. She remembered how she had turned into the driveway at 11:20, fumbling for her house key in the dark as she ran from the car. All the downstairs lights were still on in the house, and once she was inside, she went straight to the study. The horror of what she had found replayed in her mind, as it had been doing incessantly. Her father was slumped across his desk, his head and shoulders bloodied. Her mother, soaked in blood, was cowering in the closet near the desk, clutching her father's pistol.
Mom saw me and started moaning, "So much noise! So much blood!" I was frantic, Mariah remembered. When I called 911, all I could scream was, "My father is dead! My father has been shot!" The police arrived in minutes. I'll never forget how they looked at Mom and me. I had hugged Daddy, so I had blood all over me, too. I overheard one of the cops say that by touching Daddy, I had contaminated the crime scene. Mariah realized she had been staring unseeingly into the mirror. Glancing down at the clock on the vanity, she saw that it was already 7:30. "I have to get ready," she thought. "We should be at the funeral parlor by 9. I hope Rory is getting Mom ready by now." Rory Steiger, a stocky 62-year-old woman, had been her mother's caregiver for the past 2 years. 20 minutes later, showered and her hair blown dry, Mariah came back into the bedroom, opened the door of the closet, and took out the black and white jacket and black skirt she had chosen to wear to the funeral.
That was The Lost Years by Mary Higgins Clark. Megan is a suburban soccer mom who, once upon a time, walked on the wild side. Now she's got 2 kids, a perfect husband, a picket fence, and a growing sense of dissatisfaction. Ray used to be a talented documentary photographer, but at age 40, finds himself in a dead-end job. Broom is a detective who can't let go of a cold case, a local husband and father who disappeared 17 years ago. In Stay Close by Harlan Coben, 3 people are living lives they never wanted, hiding secrets no one would ever suspect. Even as the terrible consequences of long-ago events crash together in the present and threaten to ruin lives, they will come to the startling realization that they may not want to forget the past after all. And as each confronts the dark side of the American dream, they discover the hard truth that the line between one kind of life and another can be as whisper-thin as a heartbeat. Scott Brick narrates.
The A-List Mega Package also came with a souvenir DVD for no extra charge, plus your face on one of those cheesy fake gossip magazine covers with a custom-made headline. The cost for the A-List Mega Package? $4,000. To answer the obvious question, yes, Ray hated himself. Ira pushed past and disappeared into the ballroom. Ray lowered his camera and looked at his 2 fellow paparazzi. Neither one of them had the loser L tattooed on their forehead because really, it would have been redundant. Ray checked his watch. "Damn," he said. "What?" "We still have 15 minutes on the clock." His colleagues, both barely bright enough to write their names in the dirt with a finger, groaned. 15 more minutes. That meant going inside and working the introduction. Ray hated that. The bar mitzvah was being held at the Wingfield Manor, a ridiculously gauche banquet hall that, if scaled back a tad, could have doubled as one of Saddam Hussein's palaces. There were chandeliers and mirrors and faux ivory and ornate woodwork and lots of shimmering gold paint. The image of the blood came back to him. He blinked it away. The event was black tie. The men looked worn and rich. The women looked well-kept and surgically enhanced. Ray pushed through the crowds, wearing jeans, a wrinkled gray blazer, and black Chuck Taylor high tops. Several guests stared at him as though he'd just defecated on their salad fork. There was an 18-piece band plus a facilitator who was supposed to encourage guest frolicking of all sorts. Think bad TV game show host. Think Muppets Guy Smiley. The facilitator grabbed the microphone and said, "Ladies and gentlemen," in a voice reminiscent of a boxing ring announcer, "please welcome, for the first time since receiving the Torah and becoming a man, give it up for the one, the only, Ira Edelstein." Ira appeared with 2. Ray wasn't sure what the right terminology was, but perhaps the best phrase would be upscale strippers. The 2 hot chicks escorted little Ira into the room by the Ray got the camera ready and pushed forward, shaking his head. The kid was 13. If women who looked like that were ever that close to him when he was 13, he'd have an for a week. Ah, youth. The applause was rapturous. Ira gave the crowd a royal wave. Ira, Ray called out, are these your new goddesses? Is it true you may be adding a third to your harem? Please, Ira said with a practiced whine. I'm entitled to my privacy. Ray managed not to vomit. But your public wants to know. Fester, the sunglassed bodyguard, put a large mitt on Ray, allowing Ira to brush past him. Ray snapped, making sure the flash worked its magic. The band exploded. When did weddings and bar mitzvahs start playing music at a rock stadium decibel into the new celebration anthem, Club Can't Handle Me? Ira dirty danced with the two hired helpers. Then his 13-year-old friends joined in, crowding the dance floor, jumping straight up and down like pogo sticks. Ray fought through Fester, snapped some more pictures, checked his watch. One more minute on the clock. Paparazzi scum! Another kick to the shins from some little cretin. Ow, damn it, that hurt! The cretin scurried away. Note to self, Ray thought. Start wearing shin guards. He looked over at Fester as though begging for mercy. Fester let him off the hook with a head gesture to follow him toward the corner. The corner was too loud, so they slipped through the doors. Fester pointed back into the ballroom with his enormous thumb.
Kid did a great job on his haftarah portion, don't you think?
Ray just stared at him.
I got a job for you tomorrow, Fester said.
Groovy. What is it? Fester looked off. Ray didn't like that. Uh-oh.
It's George Queller.
Dear God.
Yes, and he wants the usual.
That was Stay Close by Harlan Coben.
Social media. It's got everyone buzzing these days. But what is it really, and how can you put it to work for you? More than just a passing trend that's hot today, gone tomorrow, social media is marketing that is making a difference for savvy business people who have jumped into the future. Magic Buzz is a new online marketing company so unique, we've even coined a special phrase for what we do. Socio-viral. We combine the word-of-mouth friendliness of social media like Facebook and Twitter together with the viral reach power of YouTube to create the socio-viral effect. Magic Buzz's socio-viral solution provides the measurable value of online advertising that works, affordable, and effective. So get the buzz going for your business. Magic Buzz, with only one Z, because we're never asleep. Visit us at magicbuz.com. For more information or any questions, please feel free to email us at info@magicbuzz.com. Magic Buzz, we're there when you can't be.
Private investigator Dana Cutler and attorney Brad Miller have overcome more than a few daunting challenges and powerful enemies to see justice done. Now, in Philip Margolin's capital murder, wicked threats old and new are about to bring them together once again. Convicted serial killer Clarence Little has escaped from death row in Oregon. Brad begins receiving threatening messages in D.C., where he works for Senator Jack Carson, a high-ranking member of the Senate Select Committee on Intelligence. A dead body, murdered according to Little's M.O., is found in the senator's Georgetown home, and Carson has disappeared. While Dana is in Oregon digging into the senator's background, a terrorist cell is poised to destroy a packed professional football stadium in one of the biggest attacks on American soil. As the senator's personal life begins to dovetail with the cell's evil plan, Brad and Dana will risk everything to uncover the truth and save their country. Jonathan Davis narrates.
Nadim had seen him begging outside the luxury hotels and steel-and-glass office buildings that stood only blocks away from Nadim's squalid slum. Nadim knew the American lived in the worst part of the slum, in a lean-to that stood close by an open privy. Most of his neighbors avoided him, because they thought he was insane and violent. Nadim had heard a rumor that he had badly beaten some men who had tried to extort money from him. "Let's go," the American said in perfect Urdu. Another surprise, since the American was so silent that many thought him mute. A filthy hand gripped Nadim's elbow and propelled him out of the alley. "Thank you," Nadim said when they were back on the street. Then he saw the blood seeping through his rescuer's rags. "You're hurt," Nadim said. The American looked down, then said, "Shit," in English. He pressed his hand against the wound and stumbled. Nadim made a quick decision. "Come with me," he ordered. "I'll be okay," the American said. Then he gasped and his knees buckled. "You will not be okay if you don't get medical attention." Nadim snaked his arm around the man's back and looped one of the man's arms across his shoulder. Together, they shuffled away from the alley toward the mosque. When Imran Afridi's housemen escorted Rafiq Nasrallah onto the patio in the rear of his mansion, Afridi was sipping mint tea and watching the waves break on Clifton Beach. Karachi was stifling this time of year, but the breeze from the Arabian Sea cooled the air in the wealthy suburb where Afridi had built his estate. The Pakistani businessman was wearing a long-sleeved silk shirt that clung to his broad shoulders. When he stood to greet Nasrallah, the loose sleeves moved with the breeze. Afridi was 5'7", with the barreled chest and thick legs of a wrestler. His straight black hair was receding from his prominent forehead, but he had compensated for his loss by growing a thick mustache below his hawk-like nose, making him look vaguely like a desert sheikh in an old Hollywood movie. Nasrallah was 2 inches taller and as solidly built as his childhood friend, but his full head of thick black hair and his smooth skin made him look much younger than 40. Nasrallah and Afridi were sons of wealth and had been educated at Cambridge before returning to Pakistan to work in their family's varied enterprises. They had also embraced radical Islam together. Afridi could tell from the strength of his friend's embrace that Rafiq was excited. "We may have struck gold, Imran," Rafiq said, as the two men sat on either side of a circular glass-topped table. Rafiq gave Afridi a photograph. Rafiq stopped talking while his friend studied the picture. The smile disappeared from Afridi's lips, and his countenance reflected intense concentration. "He calls himself Stephen Reynolds, but I don't think that's his real name. He's 23 and from Ohio, where he was studying engineering," Rafiq said. "Also, he has a background in chemistry." "Go on," Afridi said when Rafiq paused to make certain his friend understood the full import of what he had just said. "A few months ago, Reynolds looked nothing like he does in this photograph. He was begging for a living, and his home was a hovel in the slum where one of Imam Ibrahim's students lives. This student was attacked by 2 robbers. Reynolds saved him, but he was stabbed. The student took him to the mosque, and the Imam summoned a doctor. The wound was serious, and Reynolds was suffering from malnutrition. He also had a drug habit. The Imam nursed him back to health. While he was at the mosque, he and the Imam became close, and Reynolds told him why he was living in a Karachi slum. Reynolds went to a private high school that offered Arabic, and he became fascinated with Islam."
That was Capital Murder by Philip Margolin. The Edgar Award-winning C.J. Box delivers a thriller I loved. Back of Beyond kept me guessing almost all the way through its memorable trek through the backcountry of Yellowstone National Park. Cody Hoyt, while a brilliant cop, is an alcoholic struggling with just 2 months of sobriety when his mentor and AA sponsor Hank Winters is found burned to death in a remote mountain cabin. At first, it looks like suicide of the man who's fallen off the wagon, but Cody knows better. When clues found at the scene linked the murderer to an outfitter leading tourists, including Cody's son Justin, on a wilderness horseback trip into the park's remote corners, Cody is desperate to get on their trail and stop the killer. Holter Graham does a great job performing this work.
Outside his driver's side window, two men wearing dirty jeans and hoodies and ball caps push their way out the door of the bar. He recognized them as sapphire miners. Sapphire mining was a small industry in the county, and there were scores of one- and two-man claims that had been worked for years and still produced. The miner in the gray hoodie was practically as wide as he was tall. The one in the yellow hoodie was gaunt and skeletal, with eyes sunk deep in their sockets. They were laughing and shoving each other. Yellow Hoodie had a 12-pack of Coors Light under his arm for the road, and he'd no doubt leave a trail of empties all the way up into the big belts to his little one-man mine. They looked up and saw him parked, but didn't straighten up or try to act sober. He was just a guy in a muddy SUV to them, because the vehicle was unmarked. Even the plates didn't give him away because they were skip plates. If anyone ran a check on them, they'd come back to a fictitious address and company name.
Cody? Edna asked.
I'm here.
Did you get that?
Yeah.
The complainants called from the York bar. They agreed to stay there until they met the officer so they could guide him to where the cabin is. Officer Doherty was dispatched to the scene, and he is there with them now taking their statements. Should I ask them to stay until you get there?
Not necessary, he said. I know the cabin. Tell Doherty to proceed. I'll meet him there. What did they say about a body?
Not much, really. They said they thought it was an old place by the look of it, and they poked around inside a little. They said that they think there's a body there because of the smell and what looked like a human hand, but they didn't actually see the body. They said it was raining hard and getting dark, and they just wanted to get out of there.
Male or female body?
They don't know. They said the hand might have been a glove or the arm from a dummy because it didn't look real.
He nodded to himself. Fire turned human bodies into sexless grotesques. He'd been on the scene where the fire was so hot the dead muscles of the arms and legs cooked and roasted and contracted the body into a fighter's stance, arms curled against the chest and knees bent like a boxer in the ring. And the smell, like charred pork.
Outside in the parking lot, the two miners put the 12-pack on the hood of a pickup and pulled out two cans and opened them. The spray from a can hit Fat Gray Hoodie in the face, and he bellowed a laugh as he took the beer.
Okay, Cody said to Edna. He said, Edna, call Larry. Tell him I need him.
Larry Olson, the only other detective in the 5-man criminal investigations division whom Cody thought was worth a damn. Olson was short, solid and shaved bald, a flesh-colored fire hydrant who entered a room like a quiet exclamation point. Larry Olson was a Montana legend. He'd solved crimes by careful observation and exhaustive investigation. He wore suspects down. He wore his fellow detectives down. When an unsolved crime went on too long anywhere in the state, the call went out to borrow Larry Olson. The word was the only reason he stayed in Helena instead of going state or federal was that he wanted to be there for his three boys, who lived with their mother in town. Edna said, Larry's not on call tonight. She waited for him to acknowledge, but he didn't. Finally, she said, Cody? He held the phone out away from him at arm's length and made a gargling sound in his throat that resembled static. He said, I'm losing the signal right now. Call Larry. I'll call back when I get a better signal. And closed the phone and dropped it to the seat.
We've just heard Back of Beyond by C.J. Box. Thanks for tuning in to the first installment of our summer reading shows. If mysteries won't make your packing list, go to bookreportradio.com for titles that are being talked about now. Or check back in a week for the next chapter of The Book Report.